Okay, we'll begin. My subject this afternoon, when Grant called me, he says, I would like for you to take the subject dealing with difficult people. And I think I laughed, and I still laugh. When I got the schedule, it came out just a little bit different people and personalities, the work of elders. But essentially, what he told me in the very beginning remains the same, and that is that it's dealing with sometimes individuals that are extremely difficult. Now, I want to say in the very beginning that I do not have a degree or a license in counseling. And the only thing that I have picked up is things that have been learned basically the hard way. And, I have attempted, not because necessarily I wanted to, but because in the past that things have occurred and I felt like I at least ought to try. I've tried two different couples as far as marriage counseling when they were going to get a divorce. Evidently, I wasn't very good because they finally ended up getting a divorce anyway. But we tried. And I know that there's a whole lot of people that are a whole lot better in this particular area than I am. When the word difficult is used, I want to limit my remarks just a little bit because I think difficult can be used in different avenues. Difficult can mean, I don't know who it was, maybe Tom, just a few minutes ago, talked about body odor. How do you approach people? How do you talk to people when the odor is so bad that it is a stumbling block for everybody around them and for you as an individual? What about language? I do very well to speak the English language as good as I do. And, language is definitely a problem for us, at Chapel Glen. We are in a particular area where there is many, many Hispanic individuals moving into the community. There is no one within the congregation that has a Spanish speaking, ability that I'm aware of. That is going to become more and more of a problem. What with those individuals that are confined? And I'm just trying to throw out possibilities here of difficulties that individuals have. What about the individuals that have disease, contagious or non-contagious? How do you treat them? What about mental and physical handicaps? And those particular areas I don't choose to talk about this afternoon. They're problems. I agree that they're problems. And the solutions in many instances to those particular problems are going to be on a individual basis probably, rather than a big effort to do something about them. There's all kinds of problems, but the ones that I particularly want to think about this afternoon has to do with anger and depression and stubbornness and constant criticism and these type of problems. How do you handle being in a leadership position? Many, many times they are directed at you. And what's your response going to be? And that's I basically took it upon myself to define it just a little bit. In some of these areas, judgment is going to be required, and not everything is going to be done every time exactly the same way, because people and personalities are different. I am amazed how some people act, and they don't think anything about it. I'm at a loss to deal effectively with them. I will in just a minute. I try to get along with everybody, but when people specifically start biting at me, I get defensive, and I want to bite back, and I know I shouldn't, but that's human nature. I guess my nature, I should say, and that's something that I have to watch. When they take out after me, then I get very defensive. When it's church related, the anger, basically the disappointment, something has happened, whether it be somebody else or me, they're angry. They make scathing remarks. You're partial. They want to bring in my family, your family, everybody's family. And particularly if the problem goes over a particular length of time, it bothers me. And it bothers me greatly. I remember once sitting in a meeting that my arms were just covered with hives. Didn't have any problem. It was just over as soon as the meeting was over. But it affects an individual, and it affects you greatly. You can't sleep. You worry. You think about the problems and what might be the solutions on a continual basis. And you just can't get it out of your mind. You play it over and over and over in your mind. And sometimes it's good to talk to somebody else. But when it comes to church problems, a lot of times you can't talk to anybody else. And it's you. And it's God. And about the only thing that you can do is ask the Lord for help and guidance, wisdom, and you go on. And it's not confined to the church. In your jobs, the people that you hire, you see newscasts of individuals. John was asking for specifics. You look at your neighbor. You look at the little leagues and the parents that run out on the field. They yell and scream and holler at the referees because of a particular call or a particular call specifically against their child. And there's fights. And this is just a reaction of people. And sorry to say that it happens in the church too. And it shouldn't be. My wife would probably say I'm difficult to get along with. I make up my mind. I get stubborn. I don't want to talk when I'm angry. But I can look at her and say she's difficult to get along with too. And I think all of you can say the very same thing. And the point that I'm attempting to make is that all of us at one time or another can be difficult to get along with. And just depending upon the on the circumstances. You take kids, and I'm talking particularly of teenage years, extremely difficult sometimes to get along with them. And you talk to the kids, and they have a completely different perspective. Their parents is horrible to live with. They just don't understand. And the conflicts that go on between the families, or in the families. Most of the time, church people are okay, with the exception of when it comes to correction or discipline or something's wrong, and you have to sit down and correct. And then people get very, very defensive. I don't like confronting people. I don't particularly like them confronting me. Because when they do, they're generally angry. Somebody's been offended. You shouldn't have said that. You left the wrong impression. The attitude implied is don't you dare touch my family. I know what they did wrong, but don't you dare say anything about it. Don't do anything about it. You try to talk to the individuals involved. You talk to them or confront them, or I don't want you to do that. They'll never be back. Your relatives is not perfect either. Just look at your kids. And it goes on and on and on. Why aren't you doing something about XYZ family? They're worse than I am, or worse than whatever the problem might be. And I guess the solution, not the solution, but one of the things that we need to realize is whether it's your family or my family or whether it's me or you, we all have to align that Bible standards. And I was an administrator in school. I am very happy I'm not an administrator, because the individuals that I was over, they did not have the same standards as I did. And at least in the church, when you're working with individuals, you more or less have the same standards. And everybody knows basically where you're coming from. And that's a big help in many, many ways. Our attitude is extremely important. I observe you and your speech and actions towards other people. And that is going to leave an impression on me. And it leaves an impression on everybody else that sees or hears what we have to say. And when it happens within the church building, per se, or on the steps on the outside of the building, it's terrible for both the congregation and for outsiders that might be present. Because the impression that you're making is bad. It's something that shouldn't be. Now, John, did I answer your question at least in some aspect? He's shaking his head no. Oh, okay. Now, for those of you that are here today, I've just told you some of the difficulties in elders and deacons and evangelists and their work. And your ability is tested publicly and privately every time you get to step outside the door, it seems like. And I think one of the things that you come to the conclusion is real quickly, and that is that you can't do it by yourself. You've got to have some help. And there are many rewards in leadership. Sometimes you get somebody that will listen, and it's pleasant. Sit down and talk with them and tell them concerning Jesus. The individual would accept, and he would be immersed, or she would be immersed. Sometimes you're teaching young people classes, and you have individuals in the class that not only accept Christ, but develop as a speaker or a leader, and you can look back over a period of years and see the development, not only in a particular class, but, well, I don't know, Rick was determining how long I've been an elder. I think he said 35 years or something. You can look back in the congregation, and you can see growth of individuals where they started out basically as a baby, and they have grown tremendously, and that's a reward. Your leadership as far as congregational goals, you can see, you establish a goal here and you can see the conclusion. It's satisfying. You had a hand in it, and every time I say you had a hand, I include the Lord in that. In 1 Peter, the 5th chapter, verse number 4, there is a tremendous reward that is available for individuals in leadership positions. And that is, I think that the Lord knows that there is difficulties, and that you are going to be dealing with people that are not always friendly towards you. And he's talking specifically of elders, I believe. And it says, when the chief shepherd shall appear, ye shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away. No higher reward. John was talking about, the last time that I was here, I think that was Friday, concerning qualifications as far as an evangelist was concerned, and one of the things that I would like to hit is it goes along a little bit with what his presentation was. You need to prepare now, and leadership position may not be several years. But you need to go ahead and prepare. Ecclesiastes, the 12th chapter, verse number 1 says, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, and the evil days come not till the years draw nigh. And I should say, I have no pleasure in them. I look back, and what I'm going to say, you can probably classify as bragging, but I don't particularly want you to take it that way, because it's just some facts. I want you to try to look at what I tell you, and then put the same thing to practice in your life. Not in the same way, well, not in the same specifics, but in generalities. My dad was a plumber. He was an electrician. He was a photographer. He was elder, he was an evangelist. And while I was home, I was able to travel and work with him. When he got down in the ditches, I got down in the ditches too. I carried two, basically, for him. My granddad was a farmer, and growing up at home, I was in FHA. I was in 4-H. I had a project. It was sheep. I didn't realize at that particular time that it was going to be an asset to have sheep. It was just one of those things that it was there, and my dad said, do it, and I did it. After I went to college, I moved to Indiana. I got involved in construction. Helped build some houses. I was a teacher in industrial tech, and all of the different, the woods and the metals and the plastics and all of that, we did. And so what I'm trying to tell you is the experiences that I had have helped me. Spiritually speaking, when I was a kid, my dad and Roy Harris got together and took me and some other boys from Northern Missouri, and we went to Colorado, as I told you the other day. I've traveled with Richard Riggins and with Roy Loney and Kenneth Van Dusen and Roy Harris. I did a little radio work with Bill Hensley. And all of the different experiences that I had have helped me. And what I'm trying to say, I'm not trying to brag about me, but the vast experiences that you can have is going to help you in the leadership role that you're going to be faced with. I don't have a lot of knowledge about any particular thing. I've got just a little in, and I am not a people person. But at least when I come up against somebody that I don't know, at least I have some basis for talking with the individual. I am not a good conversationalist. And, it's hard for me to just sit down and chit-chat. But at least when I have the opportunity, I don't feel so dumb, if they're a machinist or a truck driver or whatever it might be, I can talk to them a little bit and establish common ground. The other thing that John was talking about was the classes in school. And one of the things that leadership position is just about going to require some knowledge and I did not have any official classes. Glenn Owens and I, we went to a layman's class as far as counseling for, I don't know, approximately a year, one night a week, and we gained a little bit of information on how to counsel individuals. And, I appreciate that. But counseling and public speaking and English and music, particularly the song leading part and the ability to read some notes, technology, the use of computers, and I'm going to get myself out on a limb here. Spend a weekend or a week with some of the brethren that are raising sheep. Spend a week or a weekend with some of the brethren that are building houses. Christ was a master at using comparisons and illustrations. And I think one of the things that I need, one of the things that you need, is the ability to, when he says the house was built upon a rock, well, why? What's the foundation, he says, Peter, foundation? What's he talking about? What does the foundation of the house do? And he talks about sheep and the various agricultural type pursuits at that time. And if we understand where Christ is coming from, and we have just a little knowledge of what's going on, then we too can make applications and illustrations that people today, when we talk with, can understand. It may not be the same type in the same way as it was in the olden days, but he talks about no man having put his hand to the plow and looking back fit for the kingdom of God. Why? Well, in that particular day and age, you put your hand on the plow and there was a weed or there was a fence post or a tree or something way, way on down. And in order for that furrow to be straight, you concentrated on what was way down the line. Because if you didn't, your furrow just went in and out and all over the place. And farmers at that particular time were known, as far as community, he can plow a straight furrow. And this is the type of thing that I'm after. You're facing all kind of people, and you need to have the ability to relate and talk to them. Questions or comments? Tom.
I was going to make an analogy here from your experience with this effort. Are there difficult sheep?
Yes. I'm going to talk about difficult sheep here in just a minute. Yes, sir. That's right. And see, I'm at a disadvantage because I grew up on a farm. So I got just a little advantage. I taught in inner city school for about 43 years, so I know how the inner city thinks, at least a little, and I can convey that. But knowing what life is like on the street, I really can't relate to that. I know the problems that result from it, but that's one area that I don't have. And some of you may have far more abilities in that area than I do. Yes?
I think it's always good in a situation where we see that we don't ask the question.
Very good. Yes, Donna. That's right. Yes, Lonnie. I wish I knew something that did work. Calm, cool, and collectedness is one of the big attributes. Most people generally get very angry and upset, particularly when you start talking about you should or you shouldn't, or whatever. Yes, sir. And I'd probably say, you're right, I don't. And then try to go. But at least my understanding of the Bible, whatever it might relate to you, is that drunkenness is wrong. I have never drank. I've never been drunk. Do I know what drunkenness is? No, I've seen it in people. But I really can't relate to how it is, because I've never been there. Okay. Difficult people come in all shapes and sizes, colors, sexes, and young? No. They're everybody. And I guess I read two books in preparation for this lesson. And one of them used illustration, and it's an illustration that I can relate to, so I'm going to use it to you. And that's in an industrial tech individual sandpaper. Sandpaper is made for a particular reason. And sandpaper has little bitty particles. Sometimes there's a little bitty. And other times they're parts. If you're gonna sand the floor with one of these big orbital type floor sanders, you know the grit on the sandpaper is pretty good size. And it's big for a reason. And that is that when that grit goes across the wood, it's gonna tear. And you want to tear the old varnish and whatever stain, whatever was there, off, and you want to do it in a hurry. Now it's going to leave the wood very, very rough. And skip to another illustration. If you're working on a piece of furniture, you don't want that type of sandpaper. You want something that is smoother. And it comes in all grits and all sizes and all kinds. You can get cheap sandpaper, you can get expensive sandpaper, some sandpapers for wood, some sandpaper for metal. And it affects the material that you are sanding completely differently. As an illustration, wood. In wood, you've got annual rings. That's what makes up the portion of the tree. That's their heart. And you've got the sapwood, which is extremely soft. Now you use a big, large, heavy grit paper, and you're going to tear out the soft wood, but it's not going to do very much to the annual rings because they're hard. You want something that is smaller so that you're, when you sand the soft part of the wood, it doesn't remove it, but yet it removes the harder part that's sticking up just a little bit. With that illustration, the purpose of sandpaper is to cut. And sometimes you want to roughen the surface and sometimes you want to smooth it. And people are just exactly like sandpaper. Some people that you come in contact with, they're like that great big old floor sander that's got the big particles on it. They just, when they talk to somebody, they just cut all the way across and they cut deep. And then there's other individuals that when they're talking with individuals or with you, whatever it might be, they're smoother, they still cut, but it's not as abrasive as some of the others are. Proverbs, the 18th chapter and verse number 1. It says that death and life are in the power of the tongue. Now it gives you two choices, death and life. Now, the cutting. Sometimes cutting is necessary. But I'm talking about difficult people to deal with, and we're not talking about nice things in this particular arena here. But death and life are in the power of the tongue, and we're focusing more upon the death. What did I say? Oh, I'm sorry. Because I got here in my notes 18:21. Thank you. Then in Matthew, the 12th chapter, verses 34 and 35, it talks about the speech and the speech that comes from, the inner part of the individual, the thinking part, the mind. And that's how, the mind is going to function. And, sandpaper you may think is rough, and it is. The barbed wire is heavier. And some people like barbed wire. Barbed wire's for a reason, and that's to keep animals in a particular area. Some animals you don't dare put barbed wire in the fence. A horse. A horse gets in barbed wire and it may end up having to kill it. Because he'll get tangled up and he'll just cut himself and cut himself and cut himself because of the barbed wire. And people are that way. It's, in many instances, it's not fun to even be around them. And then sometimes people are, you go home and you got a faucet that just continually drips and drips and drips 24 hours a day. And after a while, they get on your nerves. And people are just exactly like that. You want to shut the water off. It's just like Luke the 18th chapter and verse number 2 through verse number 6. Where you have the woman that goes to the judge and goes back to the judge and goes back to the judge and the judge finally gives in. Now that's not the illustration we're using here, but I'm after the persistence of the callers. Some individuals are always negative. There is nothing positive that basically comes out of their mouth. It's always doom and gloom and did you see what XYZ is doing? And they just pick people apart. And it becomes difficult after a while, trying to do anything about that. What's some of the causes as far as difficult people? Why do they act the way that they do? Some people do not like change. And any time that there is change, they're going to get upset. And whatever you do, it's wrong. And those in leadership, you never change. And then when you try to change, I don't like it. You did it wrong. Shouldn't have been this way. And sometimes you just can't win. Then I think one of the causes is, and I'm not going to say it's heredity, but it gets awful close sometimes to that. And that's, you look at some individuals and it's a family trait. It's the way the family reacts. The dad, the granddad, the mother, the daughter, the son. Everybody reacts basically the same way. And, they're quarrelsome, they're negative, they're complaining, they're bossy, they're hateful. Then I think another problem is there's prior cause, and that is the problems in the lives of individuals. There's divorce, remarriage, there's drugs, there's gambling, career problems, there's adultery, and whatever the cause might be, they look at other families, and these families don't have problems. How come I have all the problems? Everybody looks down on us because of the way that our family is and the problems that we're having, and they become disgruntled and upset. Another cause, I think, is the lack of friends. Some people don't have very many friends. And I know why, in some instances, they're not to have friends. You have to show yourself friendly, according to Solomon. And some people are just not friendly. They're not nice to be around. Some is due to stress, whether it be health or financial or whatever the stress maybe coming from, if it's over a period of time, particularly, there is problems that are associated. And other people are just their emotional outlook. They sit and think. And I think it's excessive thinking. They think about people, they think about things that have happened, and they always come to a negative conclusion, and it's problems, it's big problems, it's little problems, it's yesterday's problems, it's today's problems, it's tomorrow's problems, and hypothetical problems that may never come. And they worry. And they worry. And you try to give them something positive, and they will invariably go, yes, but, and whatever the problem is, my daughter got a job, or your daughter got a job. Yes, but, it's not gonna last. Yes, but, wrong end of town. Yes, but, and it's always something that is the conclusion. Gone. When you find an answer, you tell me. Yeah, I think there is. You gotta be nice about it.
Is that ever worked?
Sometimes.
Is that worked for them?
It's worked for them and it's worked for me. I don't, as I told you in the beginning, I don't have a lot of answers. I will get to the dealing with them here in just a minute, but, I think there's fear and there's anger and there's pride. Some people are embarrassed by their actions. Some people are embarrassed by their family's actions. You have an individual that has committed adultery, or whatever it might be. They're embarrassed. They're going to have problems. They're going to look at individuals and say, he was my close friend, or she was my close friend, and now they're not friends anymore. They don't come and visit with me like they used to. Some people may just need somebody to listen to. May not have very much to give them. They just need to be able to unload on somebody. Each individual is different. There's different solutions, I guess, to everybody. But how do you deal with it? And I think this is the point that we get down to. I think the very first thing is in James, the first chapter, in verse number 5. And he specifically says that you ask for wisdom. Now, there are people here that are a whole lot smarter than me. I need wisdom. Wisdom is the practical application of what I know that needs to be done, what I know that is right. How do you go about doing what you know it should, what the end result should be? And this is where we run into problems, and this is where we need God's help. You ask for wisdom. Now he's not going to give it to you, and he says, I want you to do this X, Y, and Z. I wish he would, but he doesn't work that way. And, you're going to have to study, and you're going to have to pray, and you're going to have to be open to events that are going to transpire within individuals' lives, opportunities, and take advantage of those opportunities. And I can't tell you what they're going to be, because in many instances they're different. They come in different avenues. You ask for self-control. you ask not to let people get to you. Because it's very easy to do. It's extremely easy to become part of the problem and not part of the solution. And you don't want to do that. You ask God to help them. You ask Him to help you to say the right thing at the right time and the right way. Words and ideas and everything hit people differently at different times in their lives. Just like you may hear on Sunday morning a lesson, I've never thought of that before. And the people that you're dealing with are the same way. I never thought of it in that particular name. And you need help, Lord, to zero in on a particular thing. You need to pray for them and help them solve the problem. Help in realizing that you're trying to help and you're not trying to you're not the enemy. You're gonna come across as the boss, you're gonna come across as authority, and you're the policeman, and you wanna be part of the solution, and you don't want them to look at you as the one that carries the big stick. You want them to help. You want to help them see what the Lord would have them do and say and act. Proverbs, the 15th chapter and verse number 1. I think one of the easiest things to do is we let ourselves get out of control. And it says, the soft answer turneth away wrath. Grievous words stir up anger. Keep your voice soft. Keep it calm. Keep yourself under control. They may have scathing remarks about you. You can't afford to come back at them in the same manner in which they address you. And don't expect I'm sorry or anything about like that. It may be due you. I'm not saying it's not. Yeah, I'm just saying don't make that one of your priorities. You've got other priorities right at the present time. Proverbs, the 25th chapter, verse number 11. Here he gives another illustration or a comparison. And he says, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. And the mental picture, the visual picture that he draws is that you have a bright red apple, and that's the words that you're talking or saying. And the background is silver, and there is a contrast there. You want the words to come out in the very best fashion. Ecclesiastes, and I got the wrong verse, I think. It says, the words of the wise are as goads and as nails. I've got down Ecclesiastes 12:1, that's not right. It's in the 12th chapter of Ecclesiastes there, I think. I'm sorry, 11? Okay. The words of the wise are as goads and nails. Well, what's a goad? A goad was a stick with a sharp point on the end of it. Sometimes it was metal. And you're sitting on a wagon or you're walking behind oxen. And they don't want to do what you want them to do, so you take the stick and you poke them. That's a goad. And the words of the wise are as nails. What's nails used for is to pull things together. Now, words coming from you can be the pushing or the prodding, but it can also be the things that hold their whole lives together. And the words that we say, and how we say it, and the tone and the what's the word I want, intonation, or everything that is accompanied, our attitude, our expressions, everything that goes with that is extremely important on how they're going to react to what we say. There are some words that I think that you don't want to use. You lied. You're a liar. That may be true. There's better words to use, I think. Soft answers turn away wrath at grievous words. I think that's a grievous type word. Stirs up anger. You're lazy. You're hot-headed. I don't think those are words that are going to achieve the objectives that we want to achieve. One thing that people are going to do, and that is when you sit down and talk with them, they're going to want to change the subject. You may start out talking about a particular subject and they're going to say, well, what about this? And they're going to want to talk about XYZ or somebody else's problem or something else that's going on within the church. You can't wander to other issues. You're going to have to stay on topic. One of the things that has been helpful to me is when people have come, and that is not try to deal with the situation right then and there. Allow for a cooling off period. Give yourself some time to think and plan and how are you going to handle this and what are you going to say, and how are you going to say it. Be prepared for your discussion. When you talk off the top of your head, you say things you don't feel like you intend to say sometimes. And, go to a neutral setting. If they got kids, and it's a couple that has kids, turn the TV off. Arrange for a babysitter. Do something where you can have the individual or individual by themselves where if they can concentrate, you can concentrate and you're not distracted. One of the problems that I have is listening to somebody. I can listen to them, but in the time that I'm listening, I'm trying to plot my revenge. That's the wrong word. But plot what I'm trying to, I'm going to say back to them. And it gets me in trouble because I forgot what to say. And many times, the things that they say are not really the crux of the matter. You have to read between the lines, and they may say, this is the problem. And if you will go back and if you will address the individual, now, I just asked you what the cause or what the problem was, and you told me, this is the problem, is that right? And many times, they will add to it or they'll take away from it. And you will find out that the problem is not necessarily what they have said. Maybe part of it, but there's a deeper underlying type cause than what they've addressed. And how you get there is you got to listen and read between the lines, and that's not easy. You have to try to assure or reassure individuals. You have to try to put things in perspective. You have to try to calm their fears. You have to go slow. You have to take your time. It's not something that is going to be done on an extremely quick basis. Healing hurts, and sometimes they're never healed, but healing hurts is a long, long process. And it can't be for your self-esteem. It can't be to make you look good. You may have to say, I was wrong, I'm sorry, I sinned, whatever it may be. You may have to bend a little bit. You may not be able to be as stubborn and rigid as you would like to be. Now I'm gonna stop. I got more. Yeah. Questions, comments from you? Yes, John. Very good. Appreciate that. Other questions, comments, Tom? Others. Gotcha. Yes. And my response to that. I think within the Church of Christ that when we talk about discipline, we automatically think of withdrawal. And I would like to see us get out of that particular, mindset. Because discipline, correction, is a whole lot bigger area than just withdrawing from somebody. Discipline is if you discipline yourself, you're working towards a particular goal. And that's many times what we're after. And in many instances, I realize what I say can be taken in different ways, but correction and discipline often is a process and not necessarily just an immediate change. Now, sometimes it's got to be an immediate change, but in a lot of instances, it's a process that you're working towards a particular goal, and not just a quick cut dried type action.
I think in a current term is this way that Peter first was addressing. And at the point of the question, they could have said, and humbled themselves. Well, no, that really was what we told it to. I think it could have been just a good time. But they didn't, but they were.
Okay. Lonnie. It is. And in knowing what to do. And I think when you're talking it, the flag in my mind came up. When an individual comes forward for, wrongdoing. How much information do you give the congregation? I have changed my thinking. I used to think that they need to know. And I've come to the conclusion that in most instances, the congregation already knows. And as far as do you say that an individual has gone out with this particular gal, and on December the 25th, why they went to a motel and all of this. And my answer is no. I don't think that that's needful and necessary. I think that you can say that an individual comes forward, and or when they come forward, that they have sinned in the moral arena, or words to that effect, and let everybody know why that it's happening and why that they are coming forward, but yet not be in a tremendously specific mode that will embarrass me and embarrass them and embarrass the family and Rick and John and John and Tom. You may have more experience in that than I do, but that's my thinking. Yes, sir. Wait. I think we all have. Yeah. And at least Glenn and I have come to the conclusion that instead of us standing up and trying to interpret for somebody else what the problem is or what they're sorry for, if we'll just write it down on paper, we'll read it. And that way, the individual gets to express the terms that they want to express, and then it doesn't come back on me, huh? Right. Well, we've even gone as far as when we've had to withdraw from individuals, before we send the letter, we go to the family and say, we're going to have to, we just wanted you to know so it didn't come as a shock to you. Well, we haven't gone that far, but I can see your point. I agree. Anybody else? That's right. Oh, yeah. I think one of the things that I can look at as far as work is concerned, and that was, it used to be, particularly withdrawal, that it was rather quick. And I think in many instances we've let it go too long before we've done anything about it. And that can be just as much a problem as it is if you go too quick. Where the happy medium is, I don't know. That's right. Hey, I will throw this out, and I don't know, I hadn't planned on talking about it, but I see withdrawal as an individual who wants to remain a member of the church, but will not live accordingly. Then there has to be a withdrawal. I don't see the necessity of a public withdrawal for an individual who their lifestyle is, they basically quit and they write a letter and say, please take my name off. I don't see the necessity for going through a structured withdrawal as such. You read the letter and you've taken care of what they've asked you to do. Now for that individual who still wants to be a member of the church and will not correct and will not do anything about it, then there has to be a withdrawal. But I see a difference. Wait. Not in that particular instance I had. Well, I don't know. I think one of the other problems is that the eldership or the evangelist, whatever it might be, is the one that does the withdrawing and the herniation is just going along the right. If the herniation doesn't have the input or the they haven't contacted the individual, they haven't whatever. And it's, and I don't like it, but it's basically the eldership that initiates the action and the congregation just goes along with it. My own personal opinion, just right off the top of my head, if an individual wants his name removed from membership, he's already withdrawn himself, and you just well go ahead and recognize the fact that it's that way. Go to a different congregation. Like, there's somebody at Chapel Glen withdrawn from, and they come down here to Bloomfield. I think that the congregations need to honor the Chapel Glen did it, Bloomfield should honor it. Bloomfield done it, Chapel Glen will honor it. Bonnet. When anybody is baptized, we make a public announcement, or it is public knowledge that the individual is a member. When the individual withdraws himself, or we have to withdraw from an individual, I think it ought to be dealt with in a public manner so that everybody knows it. What you ask as far as the letter, we ask for the individual to write a letter, and then we keep that letter. Or if we have to write a letter, we keep a copy of that letter. Gladys Kimmel, some of you know her and some of you don't. She keeps roll at Chapel Glen. There were services checked off through there. She makes notes down at the bottom of the page. XYZ came forward and made the acknowledgement wrong. No great big deal, but at least there is a record that on such and such a date that happened. John. That's correct. John. Not necessarily. We're more open than some congregations, I guess, but yes, that we have access to them, or basically anybody could have access. The letters, yes. We have them in a file cabinet, and many of the members can look at them, because they're public. And I'll get myself in trouble again. The wording of the letter, is important. I've come to the conclusion. Legally, and Lonnie probably can address this far better than I can. You put in a letter that somebody committed adultery, you better be able to prove it. They can go back and sue you. And some of these things is very hard to prove. And so you gotta be careful how it's worded. I'm running out of time. I'll go. One of the big things that I came across in my studies is that Grant asked me to deal with difficult people. And about 3/4 of the way through, and in my thinking, I came to the conclusion that's not really right. My job's to deal with everybody. Difficult, nice, whatever it might be. That's my job. Now, yes, there's going to be difficult, but there's nice people too. Now, my job, to the best of my ability, is to work with, to lead, to guide, to care for, to encourage, to feed, to promote good, faithfulness, courage to stand, to be upbeat to all people. Everybody within the congregation. I have to have knowledge of when I'm doing something and where I'm doing it and why we're doing it and when we're going to do it how we're going to do it, and I have to be able to communicate that publicly and privately to both congregation and to the individual. And some of the things may be very uncomfortable to talk about. But in leadership, you're going to have to get comfortable with it because it's going to have to be addressed. You need to be an example of self-control. I need to constantly check my position, my attitude, my speech, my actions, my reactions. And one thing that's hard for me, and it's going to be hard for everybody, is that you don't have to be just exactly like me. I wish you would. No, I don't. It would make life a whole lot simpler sometimes. But people are not going to be like me. And I've got to recognize that. There's going to be different. In 1848, there was a individual by the name of Cecil Alexander, and he made a statement. I think he's probably a Catholic, but that's not the point. He says, "All things bright and beautiful, all creatures great and small, all things wise and wonderful, the Lord God made them all." He made people too. When there's difficulties, it helps me build character. It helps me to bring my body under, as the Apostle Paul said. It provides balance. It helps me evaluate flaws and holes in my thinking, my actions, my speech. And it provides me an example of what not to do if I let it. And I can turn and mold hills into mountains just as well as other people can. And I have to learn to grow and mature. Many times we resist working and talking and dealing with difficult people. And I told you I was going to talk about difficult sheep. I had difficult sheep. They wouldn't do what I wanted them to do. They always found the hole in the fence when I wanted them in the barn. They always went around me. And an animal knows instinctively, I think, when you don't like the particular animal. They can sense it. And that just makes them that much more not want to cooperate with you. I think people do too. And we've got to be careful of the way that we come across. Not to let people think that there's something the matter with them. And let that influence their reaction and behavior to us. In order to be a shepherd, I had 30 sheep. I wasn't necessarily a shepherd, but in a sense I was. I learned you can't drive sheep. You gotta lead them. And in the New Testament specifically, it talks about sheep, it talks about shepherds. And in leadership positions, you're not going to be able to drive them. They're going to rebel. You're going to have to set the example. You're going to have to lead them. They're going to have to trust you. And they're going to have to see you have patience with them. They're going to have to see your example, see your stability. They're going to have to see your balance. The illustration I've got down is that the kids taking an animal to a fair, I don't care what the animal is, they have spent hours and hours and hours with that animal washing and currying and clipping the wool, whatever it might be. And the judges come along and they feel the back of that particular animal, or they open its mouth and they look at its teeth, or they look at the leg, whatever it might be. You've trained that animal to stand still, hopefully, and let the judges do what they need to do. Why? You want a ribbon. Same thing is true with people. You're trying to get them to go to heaven. You're trying to go to X time, X effort, X work, and it's hours and hours and hours in the process. It's going to interfere with your family life. It's going to be unexpected. There's going to be extremely late nights. There's going to be very, very early mornings. Nobody's going to pat you on the back. Nobody's going to praise you or even know that you're doing it. Still got to be done. We work towards reconciliation and not retaliation. My time's up, though. An example I want you to think about, and I'm not going to elaborate on it, don't have time. Esther had to deal with a very difficult individual. Think about how she did it. She threw a party. Not only one party, she threw two parties. And then there was the confronting of the individual. Sometimes it feels like we have a tiger by the tail. We see the teeth, we smell his breath, and we know he's ready to eat. We've got to hang on. We need to pray. We need to work. We need to look beyond the rough exterior. Oh, there's one other thing. In the Old Testament, and I'm taking this completely out of context, and I want you to know that. Abraham, the Lord said, I am going to bless him that blesses me, and I'm going to curse him that curses you. That's the way the world reacts. We can't act that way. 2 Timothy 2:24-26, he says that you're to be gentle to all people, in meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves. And the goal is Ephesians 4:15-16. The whole body fitly framed together grow up. Any questions or comments?
The thing, I appreciate your point about how you're supposed to help all people. And it reminds me how there's always more than enough consolation.
Right. Any other? Thank you.